for argument, Fidelity National versus Intercounty National. Mr. Schreier.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm James Schreier from the Christensen Miller firm, here on behalf of Appellant Fidelity. As the court is aware, this appeal arises out of a trial. At issue at the trial was a very long-running fraud, we contend, which escaped detection both by Fidelity, the Department of Financial Institutions, and according to defendant Stewart as well. In connection with that fraud, it became necessary to retain forensic counsel to trace the extent of the fraud over the 12 or 13 year period that lasted. That was Deloitte. The primary person at Deloitte was Mr. Pollard. Mr. Pollard traced the money and became, at time of trial, the only person who was capable of explaining to the jury the extent of the fraud and how the money was siphoned away from New Intercounty and, indeed, away from Old Intercounty. He also was critical to explain how the losses suffered and the hole that was created at Old Intercounty in the early 1990s transferred over to New Intercounty in the second half of the decade and ultimately came to rest with the escrow beneficiaries in the year 2000 when the fraud was discovered and Fidelity paid those losses. Critical also to the jury was an explanation of how Stewart directly benefited from this transfer of this hole or loss at Old Intercounty to New Intercounty. Stewart benefited because a certain number of escrow accounts in existence at the time that the Old Intercounty passed out of existence and New Intercounty came into existence were Stewart-insured accounts. It would be necessary to show to the jury hundreds and hundreds of documents lined up against these slightly less than 200 accounts to show that Stewart was, in essence, on the hook for any losses that would have been suffered had the hole not been filled with New Intercounty money. In connection with showing the jury these hundreds and hundreds of documents, we prepared a schedule which summarized these various insured closing letters, title policies, HUD-1 statements, and so forth. As the court is aware, Judge Duryagan both excluded the entirety of Mr. Pollard's testimony and excluded the entirety of the schedules. He did so for reasons that are revealed both by his comments at oral argument and in his ultimate rulings. He excluded Mr. Pollard because, in his entirety, because he found that Deloitte had discarded certain documents which Judge Duryagan believed might have shown problems with Mr. Pollard's testimony. There's no specific document indicated. There's no case cited to support the specifics of his claim. Rather, he believes that even one document in the abstract, if discarded, might have been sufficient to affect Mr. Pollard's credibility on the stand. He excluded the schedules because he said they were untimely, even though each of the documents underlying the schedule had been produced years earlier.
Were the schedules produced, the summaries, produced in a timely fashion pursuant to whatever scheduling order was in place?
Certainly, Your Honor. They were produced approximately a month before trial as part of the final pretrial conference order.
Okay.
In addition, I might add that we actually gathered the underlying documents supporting the schedule, put them in binders, and reproduced them again.
Right.
The extent of the backup documentation apparently impressed the trial court, and it is possible he confused the backup binders with the extent of the schedules.
But the backup documents had been produced long before and consistent with prior scheduling orders and orders of the court.
Absolutely right,
so
years prior.
The untimeliness ruling was not based upon a violation of a scheduling order or any other rule. It was more freestanding.
Yeah, Judge Duryagan said, I'm paraphrasing, I don't buy it that you do this out of the goodness of your heart. And he said schedules can be misleading to jurors, and he struck the schedules as untimely.
With regard to the preclusion of the expert witness, it's my understanding that the judge did not premise that ruling on any kind of a discovery violation. In other words, it wasn't a discovery sanction.
Quite right. The judge said, we are not dealing with a disclosure violation. He said that at ADD 26, in fact.
So pursuant to what authority was the witness's testimony precluded in its entirety?
One does wonder, Your Honor. It was not apparently, in the judge's mind, a problem with a order. He found he ruled in no way that any prior order had been violated, and he couldn't have done it under Rule 26, because Rule 26 talks about excluding witnesses or documents that are in the expert category that aren't timely disclosed. Both Mr. Pollard and his report were timely disclosed, and there's no argument about that. So it is very hard to fathom from the court's ruling. He was apparently impressed by the fact that Mr. Pollard and Deloitte were also working with law enforcement authorities in connection with this fraud. And I think, to be fair to the trial court, he believed that perhaps that created some new standard on an expert because there was law enforcement involved or potential criminal conduct. And one of the things I'd really like to emphasize, if I might, is that what we are talking about here, what that was discarded, were not source documents. They were not things contemporaneous with the fraud. They were, and that's fundamentally interview notes taken by Deloitte. They were contemporaneous notations. They weren't evidence of anything. Indeed, I don't believe they were properly deemed as anything that could be viewed as having been considered.
So the preclusion order was basically entered by the judge pursuant to the court's inherent authority to control the admission of evidence?
One would have to assume that, Your Honor.
And what is the legal standard that governs such a decision?
I think it's best said by Gilbert and Sullivan that the punishment has to fit the crime. The case law is all over in that area, and the judge's opinion is not very clear. As I said, he seems to be taken with the idea of the law enforcement angle, even though I should tell you that law enforcement even to this day, or the authorities even to this day, continue to want to use Deloitte and Mr. Pollard to help them. There's never been any criticism. There's nothing in the record that indicates.
What is it you wanted Pollard to testify to?
Mr. Pollard could testify about two major things. 99% of his report is about tracing the tens of millions of dollars that were looted from new and old intercounty and given to defendants and third parties.
So you think there's evidence that the Stewart companies actually benefited from this fraud?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
How did they benefit?
At the time that Old Intercounty went out of business and New Intercounty came in the 95-96 period, there were a number of escrows that were open at Old Intercounty that Stewart was on the hook for, either through title policies or insured closing letters. Money from New Intercounty was siphoned out and put into Old Intercounty, allowing those escrows to close, approximately $24 million worth.
So why did you need Pollard for that, or the summaries for that matter? It's just a matter of you're saying that Stewart was contractually obligated and therefore the money got them off the hook. Isn't that very straightforward?
It is to Fidelity. It wasn't to Stewart. Stewart would never admit in any way in the trial court that it was responsible.
But you said it was a matter of contract that they were responsible.
I said that there were title policies
issued. All right, so just show the jury the title policies.
Your Honor, some had insured closing letters.
Well, whatever it is, there are documents that establish, according to you, there are documents that establish Stewart's that show that Stewart benefited from the fraud.
Several hundred, Your Honor, yes.
Right, okay, so just give the jury, a half dozen of them, and you have your case. What do you need Pollard for?
This would address the summary, Your Honor. The summaries would show the extent.
I don't just care about the summaries. I'm talking about Pollard. Forget the summaries. Suppose you have, I don't understand the importance of the summaries either. If you don't have the summaries, well, you have the contracts. Can't put them all in, the jury will go blind or something, but you put them in and then you say to the jury, well, here's this contract, here's that contract, they're illustrative, and you can look at the others if you're interested at your leisure. What do you need Pollard? What do you need Pollard for? Case is made on documents, where does he come in?
The case against both Stewart and Hargrove, there were various types of ways the monies were taken from Old Intercounty and gotten to those parties. The satisfaction of the Stewart escrows was one way. There were also monies taken that were used to pay down loans that Stewart had issued title policies for. Loans, not escrows that were closing. Mr. Pollard could have testified about that.
But that also
Mr. Hargrove,
is contractual, isn't it?
Uh, you,
that is, Stewart had a loan, and the loan was forgiven or paid back.
Stewart had a title policy on a loan. The monies were used to pay off the lender on the loan. Stewart would have been on the hook had the loan gone into default, is the way of doing it. Right. And, Your Honor, I respectfully remind the court about Mr. Hargrove as well. The types of thefts from Oneida County were five or six different systems. Some involved CDs that were taken. Some involved paying operating expenses with escrow money. Some involved purchases from third parties with escrow money. Mr. Pollard is the only one who deciphered all those various ways that money was taken out. And he also was critical. If I may remind the court, Fidelity was suing Stewart in the shoes of the year 2000 escrow beneficiaries. It was not suing in its own right. It was critical to show how the hole that was created in the old intercounty escrow account in the early 90s got transferred to new intercounty and moved through time through the end of the 1990s into the year 2000. And how when the music stopped in 2000, and the escrows didn't have enough money because no new money was coming in, and Fidelity stepped in and paid those escrows out so that the escrow beneficiaries would be made whole, that was directly attributable to a hole that was created during Stewart's watch in the first part of the 90s. Only Mr. Pollard could trace this and show why the loss in 2000 was traceable to early years. And I might add that Judge Conlon accepted, in the face of attacks from Stewart, the abstract reasonableness of that in Ponzi schemes and in long-term frauds of this nature, a loss suffered in 1 year could travel forward in time to subsequent years. But to show how that bubble or hole moved over time is a very complicated task, and only Mr. Pollard was equipped to do it. It's perfect for expert testimony, and he was our only witness on the subject. Now, if I may briefly explain one thing with respect to the motion to amend, which is on the de novo standard, I would respectfully request that the court carefully consider Judge Conlon's ruling on our motion to reconsider. It's R-289. I mentioned this in the reply brief, but I'd like to emphasize it. She says, in essence, in her ruling on the motion to reconsider, now Fidelity has done in its motion what it should have done in its complaint. What we did in our motion to reconsider merely was take the court figuratively by the hand and show where the allegations were and what was against what party. She essentially admitted that we had everything in our complaint that was needed. She just didn't like the way it was organized. At a minimum, she should have granted us leave to amend because she has admitted the fact that it could have been done right. It just wasn't in the pleading before her. But I believe it all was in the pleading before her, and therefore the motion to dismiss on 9B grounds with prejudice was improper. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Schreier.
Thank you.
Mr. Kelly?
May it please the court, I would like to start with a quote from a case that we cite and rely on in our brief, the Salgado case. And I quote this because the issue here is not whether or not any member of this court, if you were sitting as the trial judge, would have made the decisions that Judge Duryagin made with respect to the exclusion of Mr. Pollard and the exclusion of the summaries. In Salgado, at page 739, this court said, "Under this standard, we shall affirm the judgment of the district court whenever we believe that the district court chose an option that was among those from which we might expect a district court reasonably to choose." And then the court went on a little bit later to say, "In applying this standard, we scrutinize the district court's determination to ensure that it invoked the correct legal standards and that its finding of fact are not clearly erroneous."
What was the legal standard that applied to the decision to preclude the expert's testimony in its entirety?
I think it was actually both, Your Honor. In our motion and in the argument before the court, we both argued that it was within the inherent discretion of the court, as well as it is under Rule 37 for a Rule 26 violation, although that is not explicit in the judge's opinion on this
matter. Right. The judge didn't invoke a discovery violation as grounds for this sort of sanction, and so the only authority pursuant to which the order could have been entered was the judge's inherent authority to control the admission of evidence, but even such a decision has to be made pursuant to some legal standard.
I think that's correct, Your Honor, and your review of that is still on an abuse of discretion standard.
Right, but if the judge did it arbitrarily and not pursuant to any legal standard at all, then it's an abuse of discretion.
Well, but I don't think in this case we have a situation where he applied any kind of an arbitrary standard. Your Honor, the judge had before him the arguments, and he referred to the motions that we filed where we pointed out the authority under both Rule 37 and Rule 26, as well as the court's inherent authority to control the admission of evidence. And it is clear, particularly, I would point the court not so much the original opinion, which was quite short, but to the opinion on the motion for reconsideration, where he goes on at length with respect to his reasoning in this regard.
But neither of those invokes Rule 26 or Rule 37.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So that we can set to one side.
Well, Your Honor, you can affirm the court below, though, on any grounds, and I think on a Rule 37 grounds, there's clear evidence here that there was an abusive conduct by Mr. Pollard. I quoted the last section.
Well, what is it exactly? So these notes that were destroyed, they would have been impeachment material or what?
They would clearly have been impeachment material. We don't know exactly what's there because they were destroyed. And in the Morocco case, that point is made.
I know that. But okay. What is it you think they might have contained?
Well, I think we have a snippet. In what was not destroyed, we have a snippet, and that is evidence that contradicts Mr. Pollard's own analysis and presentation of the facts. With respect, for example, he opined that Stewart knew and had knowledge of these alleged frauds. And in fact, he was told by Mr. Stymack in those interviews, in the notes that survive, that Mr. Stymack created and falsified documents. And so as a consequence, it sheds a substantial problem, it creates a substantial issue as to what did the other notes say.
Well, at best, that gets you an evidentiary presumption that the documents that were destroyed would have been in your favor, plus some good grounds for cross-examination. Is there any authority for the wholesale exclusion of the witness's testimony?
I think, Your Honor, in the cases, clearly there is. Some of the cases that we've cited in the circuit, many of them, the cases were dismissed. They go for a more severe sanction. But in this instance, the judge weighed, and this is something that he was explicit in the second opinion on, he weighed the less severe sanction of a presumption or some other sanction. He found it was insufficient because there was no way for us to know and no opportunity for us to see what was in those missing notes to use them to cross-examine Mr. Pollard. And he found that was, and Mr. Pollard, was in many senses a central figure here. And I think that he was impressed. The judge wasn't.
But I gather Pollard, I'm actually rather vague on this, but I gather Pollard, in addition to testifying about knowledge, was just going to trace the funds to show that there was a benefit to Stewart, whether knowing or not knowing. And that part of his testimony, that doesn't really matter. The notes that were destroyed were relevant to that part, just tracing the money. That's a matter of, going through the contracts.
The notes that were destroyed did go to the credibility of the records, directly to the credibility of the records. He was going to testify that I've reviewed and summarized these records, and yet the notes the notes that survived were notes where he indicates that one of these, Mr. Stymack, told him he had falsified records. And so what he was going to be testifying to was a summary of potentially falsified...
But is there any actual disagreement as to whether Stewart derived a... I mean, forget about the fraud and the knowledge and all that stuff, but is there any doubt that Stewart derived a monetary advantage from the fraud? I assume he's completely innocent, but didn't it get out of some financial obligations it would have had?
No, Your Honor, I don't agree that that is clear. They failed to establish it. With respect to the loss that Fidelity suffered, that was a loss that was in the year 2000. In fact, Your Honor asked earlier, whether or not there was other evidence in the record that could be relied upon. The evidence in the record showed that between 1995 and 2000, tens of millions of dollars were removed from the escrow account. This was during Fidelity's relationship. Fidelity itself, because they sued everybody under the sun initially, brought in all these allegations against Mr. Capriati and others regarding their thefts during that period of time. So there's no possible way, we allege, and if you look at the TRW decision of this court, you'll see that you can trace the loss from 2000 back to prior to 1995. Counsel says that Judge Conlon accepted that that their view that you can trace that bubble, as he called it, and yet she didn't do that. All she did was deny summary judgment on those grounds, said that there had been an issue of fact. They could try to trace if they could, and they could not. But with respect to the summary, Your Honor made a good point earlier with respect to what Mr. Schreier was saying. They did actually have at trial the exact evidence that they now claim they were precluded from putting on. And that was the evidence from Ms. Allen, and we rate Claire Allen, and their exhibits, Fidelity Exhibits 227, 228, and 229. These are reconciliations of the escrow accounts where they claim evidence the actual transfers. They made much of this. We objected strenuously for various reasons to the admission of these documents. They were admitted. All of this evidence was put in. And frankly, in terms of their obligation to show that they were prejudiced, if indeed there was error, which we think there was not in the exclusion of Mr. Pollard, they failed to show that because it is clear that that they put in better evidence. Mr. Pollard, had he been allowed to testify with a presumption, with a cross-examination with respect to his destruction of these documents, I submit would have been it would have been very difficult versus Ms. Allen, who was a witness who was present, who authenticated the actual documents themselves they relied upon. So this is not the gaping hole in the case. And there's another point there with respect to the allegation there was a gaping hole in the case. In the court below, when they moved for reconsideration, they told Judge Duryagin, they did not say, Judge Duryagin, you have left us with a gaping hole in the case that we cannot fill. They said, we can win this case. We're fine. We're going to go forward. We'll be good. Just give us one extra week. And Judge Duryagin declined to give them the extra week as well, I admit. But they didn't say, you have taken us out of court. They've said, we're going to be just fine. Your Honor, I'd like to move on just briefly with respect to the summaries and point out that the summaries are, in fact, also a situation where the evidence that went in was, you know, clearly came in through other means. And with respect to the standard and the rule there, it was Rule 1006, the rule of evidence, which requires that the documents and the summaries be provided on a timely basis. Now, the problem here was that there were these 59 pages of summaries. That's just the summary section that summarized, I think it was 24 or 27, I lost track, binders of documents, subsequently reduced just a few days before trial to 9 binders of documents. There are a couple of problems. One is, Your Honor, even though many of the documents were produced during discovery, they were jumbled within a half a million or a million pages of documents by Fidelity's own estimate, and I accept that number. And so as a consequence, there was no real opportunity under 1006 for us to assess these summaries, which are line item by line item, as opposed to the underlying documents in the few weeks that we had before trial.
Well, you could subject it to a spot check, and obviously, I mean, you're here with 4 lawyers today. You've got a whole battery of people who could do this for you, right, in a month's time?
Your Honor, well, it was actually just a few weeks' time, and we had quite a few other things to do. We did attempt to do a little bit of spot checking, and what we found out in the spot checking was actually some of the underlying documents were Deloitte summaries themselves, and so as a consequence, they were themselves not admissible, and so that was another reason why these documents were problematic, but we didn't have what Deloitte had summarized available to us, so there was another problem there. With the just 1 minute before I sit down, I would like to point out that we also have on appeal here the allegations with respect to the fraud claims. And there I would simply urge the court, because I'm out of time, look at the actual complaint itself And what you will see is there is never an allegation of a fraudulent transfer of any kind to my client. There are allegations of fraudulent monies removed from the escrow account fraudulently to benefit various other parties. But the only thing they ever say that we got were miscellaneous payments out of the operating account of Intercounty. And the operating account, and they even acknowledge that we had pre-existing legal rights to that money, such as remittance of premium. Yes, we had a relationship with them. And thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Keller.
Appreciate your time.
Mr. Meenum?
May it please the court, counsel. I have a very short period of time within which to argue, having gladly adopted and joined my co-defendant Stewart with respect to the issues of the Deloitte summaries and Mr. Pollard. What I've addressed, independent of the matters adopted, are the assertions that Judge Conlin's orders denying an opportunity, a third opportunity, to amend the fraud-based counts against my client were somehow error. And I also agree with Mr. Kelly's comments that the best proof of that, particularly given the de novo review, is an actual examination of the counts of the complaint themselves. Counts 5, consumer fraud, and count 9, fraudulent transfers. The problem that Judge Conlin pointed out in dismissing those counts the first time was the fact that Fidelity had not made specific allegations of fraudulent acts against specific parties, in particular my client, Mr. Hargrove, setting out the who, what, when, where, and how as to the alleged frauds. Going to the sections of the amended complaint to which Fidelity points the court in support of its position, I believe does exactly the opposite and points out the very reason for Judge Conlin's order in the first place. If you look, for instance, at paragraph 42, B and E, you have allegations that refer in every instance with respect to my client to Capriati and Hargrove, for instance. There is nothing attributed specifically to Mr. Hargrove. Most of these paragraphs also throw in defendants like Susan Pelogia, Cap Jack, one of the corporate defendants. Some of the allegations in one paragraph join in claims relating to 4 or 5 different defendants without any distinction whatsoever as to how Mr. Hargrove's particular...
Well, Hargrove was Capriati's partner, right?
That was Fidelity's intent in naming him in this manner.
Right.
He was a co-shareholder and he was an officer.
So when a paragraph alleges that Capriati and Hargrove knew something, isn't that saying, well, yes, they're partners, they both knew it. Why would you need separate allegations there?
Well, because, first of all, the proofs didn't bear that out, number one. And number two, I don't know that that was always the allegation. For instance, in paragraph...
Well, I was just looking at your 42B or whatever. I was looking at a later one. I was looking at... I was looking at one that just said Capriati and Hargrove knew something. Do you want that in two paragraphs? I don't understand. What would that add?
I'm looking at other allegations, Your Honor, that say something a little bit different, like 42B. Capriati and Hargrove improperly diverted $694,000.
Right, okay, well, exactly.
Now, they did not act in tandem.
I don't understand that. They're partners, right?
They were shareholders of the Intercounty entity.
It says they obtained a $700,000 loan. Is that correct?
I don't believe that it is correct, Your Honor.
But
that's part of the problem.
It's an allegation, right?
It's an allegation, but it goes on.
What's wrong with it? I don't get it.
Well, it goes on then to talk about Pelosa and Capjack.
Yeah, all right.
The problem is
Pelosa. What's that problem?
The problem is, as pointed out in the VMS securities case and in Coronet, you can't lump defendants together in fraud-based counts, and you can't make suggestions that defendants are liable for the acts of others, which is what has been happening here. And To take the isolated paragraphs.
Why you picked on 42? That's a description of a transaction. It doesn't say anything about a fraud.
These are the paragraphs that Fidelity's relied on in claiming that they properly alleged fraud. 50 was another one, where they say Old Inter County used escrow funds to purchase certificates of deposit. Then they go on to again talk about Capriati, Hargrove, Capjack, Pelosa, without making.
Where are you?
This is paragraph 50, another one of the paragraphs specifically highlighted by Fidelity as being an appropriate allegation.
Yes, it has a bunch of sub. What sub unit are you looking at?
I was looking initially at the beginning paragraph, talks about Old Inter County. Then we get into the Capriati and Hargrove again in A. And
it says March 1990, Capriati and Hargrove obtained a personal loan for $1 million. Well, what's wrong with that?
Well, it continues to lump together other.
But if they both got the loan together, then they belong lumped together.
Well, the other part of the problem, Judge, is
I don't know what the first part is.
After all of these allegations are made, each of the counts that asks
so point
for
to the point to the parts of the complaint that are problematic, not the ones that just narrate transactions.
I believe, Your Honor, the paragraphs that Fidelity points to itself are problematic.
They're just narratives of transactions. They don't say anything about knowledge, fraud, intent.
Well, those are what they claim are the proper allegations of fraud against.
No, there are later paragraphs that talk about knowledge and so on, right?
No, there really aren't. That's the problem. These are the penultimate paragraphs that Fidelity says support.
111, for example, says, as described above, at all relevant times, defendants, et cetera, were aware of significant deficiencies. Now, is that an objectionable paragraph?
No. But I also don't think that substantiates a fraud claim. And then the ultimate problem, Judge, is in counts 5 and 9, Fidelity simply incorporates every single prior paragraph. And by the way, all of the paragraphs that they talk about being proper allegations of fraud against Hargrove don't add up in total to $12 million in claims. Yet in each of the fraud counts that were dismissed, after adopting all of the prior counts, they say, and I'm reading paragraph 138, as a result of each of the defendant's actions, the escrow beneficiaries have been damaged in the amount of at least $35 million, the entire claim. So they've made no prior specific fraud allegations about my client, which even arguably exceeds $12,000, and then in each of these fraud counts that were dismissed, they asked for the $35,000 in damages.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Meenum. Mr. Schreier, how much time does he have? 3 minutes?
A few quick points, Your Honors. As you saw from Mr. Kelly's testimony or statement, Stewart was not about to admit either the transference of the bubble through time or the liability of Stewart on the individual escrow accounts that were in effect at the end of 1995, thus pointing out, I submit, the importance of both Mr. Pollard's testimony and the schedules. I would also remind the court that the district court limited us to 22 hours. So in total for our entire case and the defense of the claim against us. So the schedules were particularly apt under those circumstances.
This 9B issue? Boy, I mean, I must say, your complaint, why on earth do people draft these huge, sprawling complaints? What's the point?
To be candid with you, Judge Posner, this was
a
huge
mess.
Fraud. The fraud was
But all you have to you only need a paragraph in a complaint, except, of course, you have to specify you have the 9B part of it. So why don't you just say, you know, Capriati on X date knew that there were these significant deficiencies and didn't tell you. And, okay, that's one paragraph. And then Hargrove knew and Intic knew and so on?
Well, ironically, the original complaint was shorter. Judge Conlon found it not to be detailed enough, and we added 50 paragraphs to the first amended complaint. I agree with your method of pleading, and I think the federal rules under 9B or otherwise only require less than what we did. And once again, I repeat, the
Look,
judge...
Look, you can't, if you submit to an erroneous ruling by a trial judge, you can't attack that on appeal, right?
I am not attacking the fact that she made us amend from the original complaint to
so
the First Amendment.
If you just look at this 111, it says, described above at all relevant times, defendants, Intic, etc., Stewart, Hargrove, Capriati, were aware of significant deficiencies. Okay, so what are the paragraphs to which this refers?
They are contained within the original introductory paragraphs. We do allege a conspiracy among these parties.
But it's so vague. I mean, it's so vague. What are the relevant times and described above? We're on page 37. You have 110 paragraphs before this. So how is the reader supposed to pick through and figure out?
Your Honor, I cited a case called Schwartz.
They couldn't have all been aware of everything, right? They had different knowledge.
We alleged a conspiracy, Your Honor. And Schwartz versus Celestial Seasonings, a Tenth Circuit case, makes it clear, I submit, that one is allowed, in conjunction with Rule 10, to incorporate by reference in this fashion.
But how could one possibly figure out what was going on?
Your Honor, respectfully, a careful reading of the complaint, I think, would tell all that needs to be known.
Where are the allegations of knowledge, say, against Hargrove? Where is Hargrove said to know anything?
Your Honor, in our motion for reconsideration, R262, we line up each party and each specific allegation in detail.
Why isn't that in the complaint?
Your Honor, every fact that is in our motion for reconsideration is in the complaint.
Where? I'm asking you, point me where it is alleged that Hargrove, on some particular date, knew something bad.
Your Honor, paragraph 79. On October 20th, $1 million wire transfer from New Winter County's escrow account was made to Hargrove on information believed these funds were used to purchase a yacht. That's escrow money for a yacht.
Okay. That's good. That's a good. That's a good.
I think that would pass anybody's 9B, Your Honor.
Okay.
If the panel has no further questions, I see I've exceeded my time.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, well, we'll move on to the next case.